All right, everybody, you know how much I love TrueCar because it's changing car buying forever. TrueCar helps car buyers get rid of the fear that they might overpay. Just in the first 6 months of this year, over 275,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network, and TrueCar users save, get this, an average of $3,221 off manufacturer's suggested retail price. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com to find out what others paid for the car you want. Then, register to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step, very simple. Just print out your savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. To see how much you can save on the car you want, simply download the TrueCar mobile app or visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning into the podcast. This week, my guest is Thomas Friedman, op-ed columnist for the New York Times, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, and New York Times bestselling author. Very, very smart guy. Not so smart because he came on my show, but no, he's a great, great thinker and someone that I wanted you all to be exposed to if you haven't already. He has a fascinating backstory as how he got into prison and writes about every aspect of war, literally foreign affairs, economics, the internet, it's someone that I really think has a lot to say and people should hear, and I wanted him to be exposed to you guys, and I hope you enjoy it. I certainly did. Follow me online, my website, PaulMercurio.com, Twitter at PaulMercurio, and Facebook. And please, please keep spreading the word about the podcast. Send the links out. I've had some great guests on. Larry the Cable Guy, if you didn't hear it, check that out. Mark Kelly, bass player for The Roots. So we're hitting it all, baby. We're hitting it all. And thanks for checking out the podcast. Tell your friends about it. Tell your family. And see you on the road. My schedule is on my website and on Facebook. Welcome to the podcast this week. I'm very excited to have on a guest that I've wanted to have on for a very long time, someone I admire greatly, a very influential writer and thinker in the world, and I don't use that word lightly, world, someone that I've whose columns I read regularly in the New York Times and have watched regularly on a myriad of shows, including Charlie Rose, Thomas Friedman, op-ed columnist for the New York Times and best-selling New York Times bestseller author and Pulitzer Prize winner. Can't thank you enough for being on the show, Tom. Thank you very, very much.
Great to be here, Paul. My pleasure.
Just a little bit of background for my listeners. You grew up in Minnesota. I know Minnesota. I work there. There's a comedy club I work out there, and I've golfed out there, and I know you're a big golfer and grew up on the golf course, so to speak. Your dad would take you after work, and you even caddied for Chichi Rodriguez, and you're still playing. I hear is your handicap a 5? Is that right?
I still do play, and I have a 5-4 index. Fortunately, I can. Great thing about golf, you can play into your dotage, and so at 61, I can still manage to play. For how long, I don't know, but I love the game and still get out as often as I can.
That's great. How did you come to play with caddy for Chichi Rodriguez? I'm fascinated by that.
Well, in a way, it's kind of an interesting story about changes in America, because back when the U.S. Open was at Hazeltine in 70-71, which is the big championship course out of Minneapolis, in those days, the United States Golf Association did not allow professionals to bring professional caddies to the U.S. Open, because it was an open, which meant that amateurs could also take part, and it was felt that pros would have an advantage. So what they did back in those days was they had every local club nominate 5 caddies or so, and my club did that, 4 or 5 caddies. And we all met at Hazeltine a week before the tournament, and they had a big silver bowl there in the middle of the room, and they had the name of every player in the tournament folded up in a piece of paper, mm-hmm. Including Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer. And
wow.
You walked up to the bowl, and you simply pulled out a name. And I pulled out Chi-Chi. Somebody else pulled out Tony Jacklin, the great British golfer who ultimately won. Somebody pulled out Nicklaus. Somebody pulled out Palmer. That was how it was done. And so it was a bygone era, and one that is should be lamented, because it allowed young kids like me, you know, to be exposed to the greatest golfers in the world and have this once in a lifetime experience.
Yeah. I'm sure you caddied for, you know, your weekend warrior golfer. Caddying for somebody at that level, a Chi-Chi Rodriguez, what struck you in that moment about, obviously probably being awestruck, but in terms of the technical aspects of golf, what, being up that close for that lengthy period of time to somebody of that caliber, what'd you take away from that? What struck you about their abilities? What was the thing that stood out among others in watching?
Well, obviously, you know, they all have mastered every aspect of the game. They all hit the ball great, and they all hit the ball long. But what's true of the weekend golfer is true of them. You know, it really comes down to making a few more putts than not, you know, which really can define the week. We were in second place after the first day. The first day of the tournament, the wind blew like crazy. And Chi-Chi shot 73. Tony Jacklin shot 71. And I don't think anybody shot 72. I mean, there were scores in the high 70s and low 80s. That's when Dave Hill, a popular pro back then, famously said they should plow up Hazeltine and plant, you know, 30 acres of corn instead. But you know, Chi-Chi treated me enormously well, and we had a wonderful time. We made the cut. We came in 26 ultimately. But paid me $175 and gave me all the balls and gloves in his bag. And about 20 years later, some family friends of ours were down in Puerto Rico at his home course. It was in Dorado Beach. And ran into him in the pro shop, and they came up to him and said, Chi-Chi, do you remember who caddied for you at the 1971 U.S. Open, Hazeltine? And he thought for a minute and rubbed his chin, and he said, Tommy, you remember?
Oh, my God. He remembered
was because, obviously, they soon turned into pro caddies and whatnot. And so as family friends will do, they said to him, well, do you realize he's more famous than you are today? And Chi-Chi thought about that for a second and said, not in Puerto Rico.
Ah, nice. Were you intimidated at all when you're in the moment sort of talking to him about club choice?
No, the only thing I really did for him was walk off distances. And, you know, Hazeltine gave us all maps of the golf course, every tree, every sand trap, every sprinkler head, and I would walk off distances for him. Yeah. And he was very exacting. Like I would say, Chi-Chi, it's 167 yards to the middle of the, you know, of the green, or plus three to the pin. And he would say, when the ball was in the air, he'd say, I just hit that 167 yards.
Really? He would know?
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
I mean, they're that precise.
And what's he, for those of you listening who don't know, I mean, Chi-Chi was known as, I guess he and Lee Trevino were the fiery, and I mean that in a good way, sort of entertaining personalities on the tour. Most golfers, even to this day, pretty staid. And he had that patented, he'd sink a putt and then he'd take his club and turn it into a sword, and as though he were like Zorro or something. Was he like that personality-wise when the lights weren't on him, so to speak?
Oh, very much. He gave me my first sex education class, actually. We were on the practice tee one day, and he's doing his routine, you know, with the fans, everyone standing around. Yeah. And he said, Tommy, I used to be a teaching pro, but I gave up teaching. And I said, why, Chi-Chi? And he said, because I had a woman. She was a slicer, and I turned her into a hooker. And everybody laughed. And I, all of 16 or 17 years old, did not know what a hooker was. And my dad had to explain it to me. So it was I got my first sex education course on the golf course from Chi-Chi Rodriguez.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I firmly believe little and big things, especially in our formative years, inform who we are. for most of our lives. And this is, you know, I golf with my son now, who's 15, and we just love it. And
great. There's nothing better. I grew up playing with my dad, and there's nothing better.
Yeah, and when I read that about you, it really struck me because I've been trying to do that with him, and it's something, as you said, till my old age when I can barely walk, at least I can go out and play with him. And was there anything, you had such an amazing, have such an amazing career, and we'll talk about that in the world that you've traveled. And did anything happen on the golf course or in that experience, not just with Chi-Chi, but just generally sort of playing with your dad or chatting, whatever, that sort of you took into life, that sort of you tap into from now and again and doing what you do?
Well, the great thing about golf is that, I mean, I use a lot of analogies from golf, you know, that, golf is the game most like life. Bill Clinton actually made this argument to me because it's played on an uneven surface. And it's not like tennis. It's not like baseball or football where you're supposed to get true bounces. Golf is played on an uneven surface. So good and bad luck is built into the game.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about how you respond to those good and bad bounces. Do you ream out your caddy? Do you curse? Do you throw your club? Do you take it in stride? And that's why it is not an exaggeration to say if you play golf with someone for 4 hours, you can learn just about everything you need to know about them, the basic mm-hmm. core values. You know, do they cheat? Do they, you know, by watching how they respond to this ball being hit on an uneven surface.
Yeah. Is there anybody that you've played golf with and in having that experience playing golf with them, you learn more about them, anybody in particular that, and you were pleasantly surprised? Maybe you thought they were an impatient person, but turned out they were very patient or whatever it might be.
No one really comes to mind, but I played with people who cheated. And, you know, after that, I never wanted to have anything to do with them off the golf course, you know.
Please don't tell me Bill Clinton cheated.
No, I've had a chance to play with President Clinton a couple of times, and he's a lot of fun.
Yeah,
put it that way.
I can imagine. What also struck me, and maybe because my son's in seventh grade and he has an interest in writing, you talk about in high school a journalism teacher you had, Hattie Steinberg, who was a very influential force in your life, and I'd love people to hear about that a little bit, and because often you don't, you know, kids that age don't necessarily get somebody that sort of strikes a chord with them. It seems the way she did. Talk about her a little bit.
So, I really got interested in the Middle East and journalism at the same time, which was 10th grade in high school. And I had a fantastic journalism teacher, Hattie Steinberg, at St. Louis Park High School, room 313. I mean, you should know I grew up in a small sort of suburb outside of Minneapolis, a small town called St. Louis Park. I grew up there. I was born in 53, so came of age there in the 50s and 60s. And St. Louis Park, which is probably, I don't know, maybe 6 square miles, something like that. So I grew up with in the same place, not exactly at the same time. I was a little older than them, with the Coen brothers, Al Franken, Norm Ornstein, Michael Sandel, the Harvard political theorist, Sharon Isbin, the guitarist, Mark Trestman, who just got fired as the coach of the Chicago Bears, was our high school quarterback.
Wow.
So it was this very sort of interesting hamlet, you know, outside of Minneapolis, a hotbed. We all went to the same Hebrew school several years, you know, apart. Mm-hmm. And so it was an interesting place and an interesting time to grow up in Minnesota back then.
It sounds like it was predominantly Jewish, and if I'm wrong, tell me, but I grew up in
Rhode Island. The suburb wasn't predominantly Jewish, but it had a big Jewish population relative to any other suburb. By the way, if you see No Country for Old Men, the Coen Brothers classic, if you remember the scene across the Mexican border where Anthony Bourdain sets fire to a car so he can go into a drugstore and get the medicine he needs. The syringe. If you look at the name of that drugstore, it's called Mike Zoss Pharmacy. That was our farm. That was the big drugstore in St. Louis Park.
Oh, and that was sort of homage by the Coen brothers. That's really interesting. Well, the reason I ask is because I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, and has different at the when I grew up, We're Italian, and everybody in our neighborhood was Italian and Catholic. And it wasn't until I went to a different, to a public high school outside of my neighborhood that I realized, oh, there were Jewish people and black people. And I don't think that that exists anymore today. And I wanted to sort of get your thoughts on sort of growing up today versus growing up in the time that you grew up. You're a little older than I am, or maybe the time I grew up, where I don't know if it's for good or bad, if we maybe kind of had a little bit more of a sheltered or cloistered sort of upbringing. And if you think that that exists anymore today, if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, you know, others, I guess, could judge if it's good or bad. It had a big influence on me. I'm actually working on a new book now, which is in part about how to write a column and where columns come from, you know. And columns really come from a combination of where you're coming from and where you're going, you know, who you are, what value system you bring to the world, and how you see the world, both in its tectonic forces of economics and technology and nature, but also in terms of human beings and culture and the amazing and crazy and surprising things that they do. And so my chapter on growing up in Minnesota, which is where I come from, is called Always Looking for Minnesota. Because you wouldn't really understand my column if you didn't understand that I grew up in Minnesota in a time and a place where politics really worked. My senators were Humphrey McCarthy and Mondale. I grew up in a liberal district that only had Republican congressmen the whole time I grew up there. The big companies in Minnesota then, Dayton Hudson, you know, then later Target, General Mills, 3M, thought they invented corporate social responsibility. They thought it was part of their job to help fund the Symphony Hall or the Tyrone Guthrie Theater. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in a time and place where, you know, there was just this enormous stability. I went to elementary school right through high school and even early years at the University of Minnesota with the exact same group of kids.
Yeah.
And I bet the income difference between any of our parents was not much more than a few thousand dollars each way.
Yeah, exactly the same as I grew up. That's exactly the same. Yeah.
And I was, you know, being, we had two African Americans in my high school, so we really weren't exposed to that sort of minority. In fact, Jews thought of themselves as the minority, basically,
right.
You know, vis-a-vis non-Jews. Yeah, so it was, but it was a time of great optimism, and so that experience really shapes my column. Because it's what gave me an optimism bias, and I have an optimism bias. I'm always looking, hoping for, believing in somehow we can split the difference and move forward.
That comes through all of your and a lot of your work and a lot of your writing. And
Thank you.
And it's funny you talk about politics, and I know you had a stint for a year covering the White House, and vis-a-vis your time as a diplomatic correspondent starting in 1989. That you much favored sort of the diplomatic side of things because you talked about that there was, quote unquote, a lot of politics in covering the White House or being part of that corps. What do you think politics, I mean, it's changed a lot, and you say it worked back then. Does it work now for you, or does it work differently in your eyes today in 2015 than it did then?
Well, you know, back then, and maybe this is just old fartdom and, you know, what, so take it with a grain of salt. But, you know, politics was less about treating voters as consumers.
Yes.
You know, now, you know, with big data, you know, we know that you have a blue eye and a green eye. And if we can hit you with the green eye angle, you know, in your zip code, we can get you. And if we can identify, you know, whatever your spouse and her proclivities, that it's really treating voters as consumers and then just targeting them with exactly where to hit their kind of consumer G-spot, as it were, you know. Mm. And that just didn't feel like it wasn't that politicians didn't pander back then, or you know, look for or there were no populists, or but there was something. It felt a little rougher and more authentic to me back then than it is now. Now it just seems so many politicians and their campaigns are made in a laboratory, you know, with chemistry, not and aren't really organic, as it were.
Do you think the advent of the internet and social media in particular maybe has tilted the scales back toward that bygone era? Because that's a lot of this comes through your writing and sort of your conversations and discussions and thoughts about the impact of the internet and social media. And do you think that maybe social media allows the true voice of the quote-unquote consumer/voter to be maybe heard a little bit more clearly and then sort of catered to a little bit more directly?
I'm not sure. You know, I really haven't thought about it per se. I mean, we certainly have more voices. This podcast is one of them. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
The barriers to entry have gone down, and that's just a great thing, but the barriers of entry have gone down, and that can be a scary thing too, because you have all kinds of people saying all kinds of things. So it's there's still a need for somebody to filter through the noise and filter through the voices and not all noise. I don't mean to diminish it. So that's really, I think, the struggle, you know, and it's true for politicians. But what happens is what I fear is that American politics, our Congress today. Our forefathers believed that we should have representative democracy, not direct democracy. They didn't trust the will of the people in some way. So they thought the will of the people should be filtered through elected representatives. And their idea of an elected representative was a white man who owned land. You know, so thank God
right.
We've expanded that.
Right.
But nevertheless, they thought it should be filtered through elected representatives. I would argue that what has happened is that we have been quietly moving from our representative democracy back to a popular democracy, thanks to Twitter and Facebook and all these technologies, because there's something about our politics today. It feels a lot more akin to American Idol than it does to the Continental Congress. you know,
yeah.
That people, you know, it's there they go. I must catch up for I am their leader. You know, everyone's just voting all the time. What's trending on Twitter? And then I try to chase ahead of that.
Yeah.
And so I don't really spend time on Twitter, and I don't spend time on Facebook. I spend time talking to people.
Yeah.
And that can be imperfect too. But people sometimes forget all the pollsters and number crunchers that interviewing someone like you and I are doing right now is actually also a form of data collection.
So maybe you've got a great idea for a business and want to start selling your products or services online. Maybe you're an established business owner looking for new customers, or maybe you're interested in starting a personal website. No matter who you are, GoDaddy wants to help you succeed online. Right now, GoDaddy is offering a .com domain for just, get this, $1.49. You know, you can't get $1.49 for $1.49. That's a bargain, people. It's go time. Start your website today. Visit GoDaddy.com and enter promo code Paul149. That's Paul149, all one word, to get your $1.49.com. Some limitations apply. See website for details.
Yes. I mean, it's the reason I want is what you said earlier is that thanks to the podcast world, there would never have been a time when my followers, I'm not saying none of them read your columns, but you know what I mean? It's sort of like...
Absolutely.
And I'm a big believer that people should consume all sorts of information from all different sources and then make a decision. I guess I'm part of the problem, but I'm about to complain about it, is, you know, you don't. I think cable news has been good and bad. It's been made, I think, our lives very divisive. And you could argue that it's not even news. It's sort of just arms of the respective parties. But I worked on the Daily Show for a number of years, and people come up to me and say, "Oh, I only watch the Daily Show for my news." And I say, "That's not good. You should watch us. You should watch Fox News. You should watch Hannity. You should read Tom Friedman in the New York Times. You should read Brooks in the Wall Street Journal. You should read a myriad of right, left, and center sources and make your own decision about things." And I don't know if people just are too busy, too lazy, but it's very alarming.
I know, I agree, and that's what I do. I mean, I start my day, read the New York Times, Washington Post, Financial Times, and Wall Street Journal, and then the first site I really go to is Real Clear Politics. And the reason I like Real Clear Politics and Clear World is it gives me a selection of right, left, and center from all over the country and all over the world. Mm-hmm. And I like to consume opinion, but I like to hear everybody's opinion, and then I make up my mind.
Well, the beauty about your writing is that while you have positions, you're not so dogmatic that you feel like you're somebody that's unreasonable that you wouldn't want to talk to. And I do think that you write from the heart and you feel what you write through your writing. And in a world where you talk about the consumerism voting and politics that sort of is about just follow me blindly, you are really putting information out there for people to digest to make their own decisions, and there aren't a lot of you out there like that, and
well,
I admire that.
It's what I, you know, what I aspire to do. I mean, my favorite comment is when a reader comes up to me and says, "I always read you, but I don't always agree with you." I really like that because it means, one, they feel there's value, they want to know what you have to say, and two, that they're wrestling with it. And I say that about most of the people I read. I read you, but I don't always agree with you. But I don't start, you know, from a ideological construct. I always tell people about that it's very dangerous to disagree with me. And they say, "Well, that's awfully arrogant." I say, No. I don't mean it that way at all. It's really dangerous to disagree with me because I don't know anything. And so everything I know, all my sort of politics, my column conclusions, come from reporting, from building brick by brick from the bottom up, and not all, but the majority of them, and therefore you better have built brick by brick your position from the bottom up with reporting and analysis, because if it's just some ideological construct or some joke you got from Comedy Central, some riff, you know, that's not going to cut it. And so I have a very inductive way of reporting and of writing my books. I mean, I interview people, I absorb what they have to say, I put in my framework. Then that framework becomes a kind of stronger alloy, and then I talk to the next person, I absorb that, I throw out maybe some of the old stuff, and I'm always working in this very iterative way. And it doesn't mean you're going to get it right. I've had some of my real flame-out mistakes. But I've always felt it reduces the odds you'll get it wrong.
Yeah, and I you know, it's funny because it's very akin to being an attorney. I was an attorney, and you know, you're taught to build that argument case brick by brick, you know. And and I want to talk about this in a second, but there's a parallel to stand up to you talk about, you know, it's okay if people disagree with me. You know, lately in the last several days with the Charlie Hebdo situation, you know, I've been interviewed a lot about, well, where's the line in comedy, satirization, and what, you know, what won't you say, and should you kowtow to this? And my response is always, look, you know, you don't have to like what I say. If what I'm saying comes from the heart and it isn't mean-spirited for the sake of mean-spirited, my agenda up there is not to please everybody. It's to say, talk about things that I'm passionate about in a funny way, maybe move you a little bit, but not try to have everybody be my friend, because if I do that, then I'm pandering to you and I'm not being honest intellectually or emotionally. And
I always tell people, this is not a friend growth industry, being an opinion writer.
Right.
And
right.
If you're looking for friends, you know, I mean, it really is Harry Truman's Get a Dog. You know, I mean, you've got to, especially at, you know, sort of the level of the New York Times, where you're just read in a lot of places and we have a comment section. I mean, I get stuff hurled at me every day, you know.
You mean people upset with your views or your writing?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Nothing physical, thank God. And, you know, that just comes with it. You have to have a thick skin. If you're giving it out, you got to be able to take it. And,
does that ever hit you and sort of go, maybe these people are right? Or if there's enough people saying the same thing, maybe it's like, you know, maybe I'm not getting this right. Or,
yeah, you have to. I mean, I think the trick today is there's so much of it. If you sat and took it all in, all of it, you'd be overwhelmed by it. You just look in the mirror and just say, God, I'm an awful person. I mean, just look at this. I mean, these people think I'm awful, you know? That's what happens if you take it all in. If you take none of it in, you know, what invariably strikes me is if I read the comments on my column, which I don't always do, frankly. Mm. But if I do, I'm struck that it can be 200 out of 300, 270 can be hostile. 27 can be positive. The three will be flat out brilliant. And you say, wow, I never thought of that.
Yeah.
And so, like, to go into your own comment section, you got to kind of put on a wetsuit and a deep sea diving helmet, you know, and dive into the muck.
Yeah.
And just learn not to take it personally and try to learn from your critics. I like to learn from my critics. I'm really open to that. But you have to separate between the skeptics and the cynics.
Yeah.
You know, skeptics say, I don't think you're right. I think this is right. But I mean, they're really trying to make an argument. There's a whole nother group of people who just want to take you down. You know what I mean? They just want a moose head on the wall. You know what I mean? I took Tom Friedman down, you know,
right.
And the reason, whatever, if they can catch you in, it doesn't really matter. So it's kind of separating those two.
And it's funny because I have, especially after a TV appearance, there'll be Twitter comments, you know, if I go on Fox News or whatever,
right.
You know, whatever it is. And some days my wife's like, don't look at it today. Like, it's like, because some days it's, you know, and other days you look at it and I'm the same way. And, you get
the hate. Twitter, I don't look. I mean, I'm deeply suspicious of anything that doesn't require you to put your name on it and put it in pen and paper, you know.
Yeah.
And I just think it, you know, when commenting becomes so easy and anonymous, it really is not a healthy thing. So
yeah.
I don't go there. I try to let enough in to know if there's a legitimate point that I'm off track, that it'll get to me, but not so much that you get really debilitated and sidetracked. And if I start writing for my critics and not for you, not for, you know, just people who are coming to your column for insight or illumination or passion, you're gonna go completely off track. So I do limit it.
Yeah, coming out of college, and I want to talk to you about this brick by brick kind of theory of writing your columns and forming your arguments and thoughts, because you sort of took a brick by brick approach in your career, and I don't know if this is intentional or not, but I'm fascinated by, you know, your formative job out of college in journalism with the UPI, you call that the best journalism school, and explain to people why that was such a great experience for you in the, I guess, the early 70s.
Well, you know, it's what's great about working starting at a wire service and is that, you know, basically you have to do everything. You have to report, you have to file a lead, you have to update the story in 20 minutes when it changes. You have to write a picture caption and do a radio spot all in the first hour.
Right.
And so once you've done that, you first of all, you're never afraid of deadlines. Mm-hmm. That's an important development thing. And at the same time, it's just the infantry of reporting.
Yeah.
And it's great, you know, to come up through the infantry. So I like newsrooms. I love being in noisy, wild, you know, throwing stuff across the room, newsrooms, and I like the company of reporters and reporting, and I really do enjoy, you know, that kind of environment.
Yeah, and then you sort of, you know, you built from there, diplomatic correspondent in 89, a domestic policy correspondent in 92, covering the White House, economic correspondent in 94, and then foreign affairs correspondent. You started writing your column regularly for the New York Times, and were those intentional stops along the way to essentially, like, sort of cover the world with the idea, knowing in the back of your mind that you would sort of eventually be writing these columns and these books, because it's a fascinating trajectory that you've had. And talk about those stops quickly, if you can, of those stops along the way, and particularly why the White House, the domestic policy stint wasn't for you.
Yeah, you know, I in many ways, I got my start as a columnist. I had a very odd background because I studied journalism in high school with my great teacher, Hattie Steinberg, and then I wrote for my high school newspaper. I wrote a little when I was at Brandeis as an undergrad for the college newspaper, but I really got my start in journalism in 1975 because I was in London then. I had a Marshall Scholarship after Brandeis, and I met my then girlfriend, now wife, who was at the London School of Economics. And at the time, Jimmy Carter was running against Gerald Ford for president. And we were walking down the street during the election campaign in London, and the Evening Standard, which is the afternoon newspaper there and has this sort of wonderful tradition of blaring headlines on its newsstand to entice you to buy the newspaper, you know, "Brad to Jen, we're finished," you know, kind of thing. On this particular day, the headline on the Evening Standard said, "Carter to Jews, if elected, I promise to fire Dr. K." And I read that headline and I thought, wow. I said to my then girlfriend, now wife, isn't that interesting? Here's a guy running for president, Jimmy Carter, and he's trying to win Jewish votes by promising to fire the first ever Jewish Secretary of State. And I just thought about the irony of that and whatnot, and I have no idea what possessed me, but it changed the whole trajectory of my life. I went back my dorm room and I wrote a column about it. And for nobody, I didn't work for anybody. But my then wife, my then girlfriend, now wife, was from Des Moines, Iowa, and her family knew Gilbert Cranberg, who was then a legendary op-ed editorial page editor for the Des Moines Register, which is a great Midwest newspaper.
Yeah.
And on, I don't remember if it was Christmas or Easter break, I don't remember which, my wife took my column back home to Iowa and gave it to Gilbert Cranberg, and he liked it and he published it on a half page of the Des Moines Register with an Ouse cartoon.
Wow.
And they paid me $50.
Oh, that's great.
And I thought that was the coolest thing in the whole world. I had been walking down the street. I had an opinion. I went home. I wrote it up and someone paid me $50.
Yeah, and you know,
so
what?
That's how I got started.
That's how you
and,
got started. Here's an eerie parallel. I was on Wall Street doing M&A deals at a big law firm and a big investment bank, and I started writing jokes as a hobby. I don't know why. I went to Georgetown Law School. You know, I'm middle class, from Providence, Rhode Island.
Right.
My parents, high school educated. Their parents came from Italy. They had a small furniture business in Rhode Island. I made it, right? I made it. I get to go to a private function. Jay Leno is the performer that night, 150 people there. I go up to him afterwards. I print it out. I must have had 15 pages of jokes. I'm like, I don't know if you need jokes, but I don't know what I'm going to do with these. I don't even know why I'm writing them, but here you go. He goes, yeah, I'll take them. Calls me the next day. He says, I'll hire you to start sending jokes in for the Tonight Show monologue because I need fresh material and you write, your voice is right. Calls me the next week, does my first joke on the Tonight Show. And it blows my head off my shoulders. And guess what he paid me for the joke? $50.
Oh, that's so great. Do you remember what the joke was?
The joke was about this old house and how it didn't – it's under a different name now, but it was the first, like, restoration show ever on TV. Remember, they would go into – so on PBS. And I said the idea of the joke was that it did not reflect reality at all because on the show, the guys clean – the contractors clean cut and very polite. On time, under budget, but in real life, you know, they haven't bathed in days, they're drunk, they're hitting on your wife, you know, that kind of thing. And he did it, and he got a huge laugh. Now, here's a middle-class Italian kid from Rhode Island working on literally deals that were on the cover of the Wall Street Journal in the business section of the New York Times. This little $50 joke had more power over me than anything I had done. And
that
started me on my way. Eerie terrible.
Yeah, so I ended up writing op-ed pieces for the Minneapolis Star and Tribune and Des Moines Register throughout college. And then when I graduated from Oxford, I went to graduate school at Oxford ultimately, studied Arabic and Middle East history, I had never covered a fire. I'd never covered a city hall meeting. Mm-hmm. But I had written these ten, I think it was, op-ed pieces. And I used those to get hired by UPI in London.
Mm. Wow. That's amazing. That's at that young age, and that you started this when you were in high school, your interest in 10th grade is amazing to me. And I want to go to what you do now, but when you started as a foreign affairs correspondent in 1995, you had an interesting theory that you talk about in the things you wanted to do, two things you wanted to do with your column. You broaden the definition of foreign affairs beyond the traditional, which ties into your theory of globalization, which is in your book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, Understanding Globalization, but broaden the definition of foreign affairs and write, and secondly, write so it was generally accessible, and talk about your definition of foreign affairs and this idea of globalization. And I wanted to jump into what's happening today for a second.
Yeah, well, this you really got it very, very accurately. I really, I thought the foreign affairs column, that we're at a time in the world where we are more connected to the world than ever, and the world was connected more to us than ever. This was January 1995 when I started, and that the foreign affairs column shouldn't just be for the readers or members of the Council on Foreign Relations. Mm. It should be for everyone. And at the same time, that the definition of foreign affairs, one of the very first columns I did was, does Microsoft have a foreign policy?
Mm-hmm.
And it was about basically the impact these global corporations and globalization were having on quote-unquote foreign affairs. It wasn't just about General Powell. It was also about General Electric,
mm-hmm.
In terms of shaping the world. And so I really kind of fused a lot of that, and I got a certain amount of resistance from the traditionalists, I think it's been borne out. My view of the world is that, there are four forces that, shape, global politics today. They're called, human nature, mother nature, markets, and Moore's Law. Three of them, Mother Nature, markets, and Moore's Law, are growing really fast.
Right.
And one of them, called human nature, moves really slow. And what I try to do, I believe the process of writing a column is about trying to produce one of two things, either heat or light. I'm either in the heating business or the lighting business. I'm either trying to illuminate something for my readers, so they'll think about it in a certain way, or I'm trying to stoke a passion in them, so they'll think about it or act about it in a certain way. And I think the way you do that is by creating a chemical reaction that produces either heat or light. And that's by how you mix where you're coming from, your own personal values, with these three large and personal forces shaping the world and how you see them interacting: the market, Mother Nature, and Moore's Law, which is to say globalization, technology, and Mother Nature. And with human nature, the crazy, unpredictable, passionate, wonderful reactions and behaviors of human beings.
Yeah. An extension of that idea of globalization is your 2005 book, The World is Flat, where you say, several technological and political forces have converged, and that's produced a global web-enabled playing field that allows for multiple forms of collaboration without regard to geography or distance, or soon even language. And I feel like that's so prescient, because in terms of use of the internet with regard to the Arab Spring and unseating the dictators around the globe, and obviously that's still playing out, combined with what happened with the interview and the use of the web as a tool of terror by the North Koreans, that there's this truly level playing field, but the use of the web and this technology in a way maybe that none of us saw coming. And I wanted to hear your thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel the world is flat, was ahead of its time. It caught the wave. The world wasn't exactly flat when I wrote it back in 2004, but it was flattening, and it's only gone in one direction since. So, and now more people have more equal power to compete, connect, and collaborate on more things for less money in more ways than ever before, and it's only going more so in that direction.
Yeah. What was your take on how Sony and the theaters reacted to North Korea's pressure about the interview, and do you see that happening potentially again? Is that something you could have, even expected to see when you were writing about this in 2004, 2005?
Well, I will just share you quickly my view, and then unfortunately I got to go.
Yeah.
But it's I was frustrated that Sony did not have the courage of its own stupidity. And what I meant by that is that I thought it was a stupid movie. I've not seen it, but everything I read about it, making a movie about the assassination of a sitting dictator, but I guess it falls into the, satirical magazine in France. Hey, it's free world, and I certainly believe that,
Mm-hmm.
And they had full right to make the movie, but having made it, they should have had the courage of their own stupidity.
Yeah.
And they didn't, which is doubly disappointing. But what I think the event illustrates and what the event in Paris reinforces is that if you're thinking about the world, so if you want to think about the world 30 years ago, you called up Henry Kissinger. And you said, Henry, tell me about the balance of power. And he would say, Thomas, you got Russia, you got China, you got America, you got the EU, you got Japan, you got India, you got Brazil. It's all about the balance, the mix. India's up, China's down, whatever it is, That's one balance of power. And by the way, that balance of power is still relevant and has not gone away. Mm-hmm. But I would argue there's a new balance of power that the flat world has thrown up now, and it's the balance of power between individual makers and breakers. Mm-hmm. Because we now live in a world where it's incredibly easy to be a maker. You can start something overnight, including a podcast. Mm-hmm. But it's also incredibly easy to be a breaker now. Breakers, bad guys tend to be early adopters. And so now what you see both in Paris and in North Korea is how these non-state, super empowered people, super empowered makers and breakers, that the balance of power between them, or us and them, I consider myself a maker, not a breaker, is also going to shape international relations. Mm. And it's kind of the four-way mix now between nation states, pro and against, and makers and breakers, pro and against. That's really where geopolitics is being shaped today.
Wow. Yeah, that is such a good point. And I got to just say, I know you have to jump. Your December 6th op-ed piece of how ISIS drives Muslims from Islam is something everybody needs to read, because that was no better on display than the beginning of this week. It was revealed that a Muslim hid 7 Jews in a freezer at the deli in France. And it was a perfect example of the point that you're making in this column, that there are a lot of Muslims that don't subscribe to, the extreme Muslims and their behavior. And you point out the brother Rashid, if I'm mispronouncing it, a Moroccan who calls for Obama to call a spade, so to speak, when he says, I ask you, Mr. President, to stop being politically correct. Just touch on that real quick before you go, because this is a really, really interesting point where there are some Muslims that don't want to have to leave the Muslim community and want to clean up the bad guys.
Yeah, I mean, there's a balance. There's a deep split in Islam. People say what happened in Paris is not Islam. Well, of course it is Islam, and the guy who protected Jews is also Islam, and that's because we do have a faith here that has no Vatican, so there's no single source of religious authority, and so you have multiple forms of Islam, and some are more tolerant and friendly to women and other minorities. Some are less, and it's going to be all about the balance of power between them.
Right. Yeah. It's a really great column. And also your January 6th column, A Time for Pause, is something people should read, because you talk about the interview and this author, Dove Seidman. I don't want to keep you. I know you have to jump, but I would love to talk to you again sometime. This has really been a great, great honor to have you on, and I hope you enjoyed it. And please read Tom's articles, the columns rather. They will shape you one way or the other. They'll maybe make some heat or make some light in you, perhaps.
But my pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's a real treat.
Absolutely. Thanks for being on, and good luck with the golf game.
Thanks so much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, so that was Tom Friedman of the New York Times, someone that I'm hoping to have back on the show from time to time and chat with us about what's going on in the world. But he's just a really, really great thinker, really cool guy. And read his material. It's not someone that tries to force his stuff down your throat. Just sort of puts it out there for you to let you digest his unique way of looking at the world. And it is a fascinating time in the world right now with everything going on. So I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did. And follow me online, Facebook, Twitter, my website, paulmercurio.com. And you can check out my tour dates. I'm all over in February. I'm coming out to the Baltimore Comedy Factory in Baltimore, February 19th to the 21st. And February 25th to March 1st, I'm going to be at the Comic Strip Comedy Club in Edmonton, Canada. I'm going to Canada in February because I don't have a life and I'm an idiot. No, it's a great club. I'm going to freeze my ass off, but I love it there. All right, guys. Thanks for checking out the podcast. See you next week.